Good evening, everyone. My name's Leslie Head, and I'm the President of the Australian Academy of Humanities. A big welcome to everyone. This is our first in-person event since the pandemic, so we're really very excited to welcome so many people in person. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, traditional custodians of this land, and pay my respects to elders past and present. I'd also like to acknowledge and thank Dr. John Valance, the New South Wales State Librarian and Honorary Fellow of the Academy, for his generosity in hosting us here at this magnificent institution, for the Hancock Lecture and other Academy events today. And I also acknowledge the terrific support of the Libraries Events team. This session is being recorded. And also, if you would like to wear a mask and you don't have one, we do have some near the door. The Australian Academy of the Humanities was established in 1969. It's the national body for the humanities in Australia, championing the contribution that humanities, arts and culture make to our national life. We're a member-based organisation with over 700 elected leaders and experts in history, the arts, languages and literature, linguistics, philosophy, culture and communication, archaeology and heritage and religion. We're one of five learned academies in Australia, and we collaborate closely with our colleagues in science, technology and engineering, social sciences, and the health and medical sciences. Together we have formed an organisation, ACOLA, the Australian Council of Learned Academies, and we work closely with this group on major projects for government that require expertise from across the disciplines to address complex challenges, such as our advisory work during the early stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. Through our advisory and public engagement work, we demonstrate the importance of bringing ethical, historical, creative, and cultural knowledge and expertise to bear on issues that matter to our communities and our society now and into the future. Part of our role in the Academy is to support and celebrate emerging leaders in the humanities. Tonight's lecture is named in honour of W.K. Hancock, the first president of the Academy. So the Hancock Lecture invites outstanding scholars at the earliest stages of their careers to talk about their work to a public audience. Sir Keith Hancock, KBE Faha, who lived from 1898 to 1988, was a Foundation Fellow and the first president of the Academy. The lecture is made possible by bequest from his estate. The first Hancock Lecture was given by then Associate Professor Christine Alexander in 1993. The 10th Academy Hancock Lecture, Horizons of National Responsibility, Law and the Protection of Life on a Fossil-Rich Continent, will be presented this evening by Dr. Frances Flanagan. Frances is a Sydney Fellow and lecturer in Work and Organisational Studies at the University of Sydney. With an interdisciplinary background in history and law, her research considers the intersection of concepts of labour, climate change, technology and the nation. We will have a short Q&A session at the end of the lecture, so please keep all your questions till then. But please join me in welcoming Frances to present the Hancock Lecture.
Thank you. I too would like to pay my respects to the Gadigal people and acknowledge their ownership of this country. And I'd also like to thank the members of the Academy and particularly Professor Leslie Head for her leadership in reframing climate as a social issue. In 2026, an event is due to take place 375 kilometres off the Pilbara coast of Western Australia that will be causally entangled with the exile of millions of people from their homes. In that year, Woodside, with the permission of the federal and state governments, will deliberately puncture the seabed that is currently safely enclosing 11.1 trillion cubic feet of carbon tetrahydride, also known as methane or marsh gas. They will process it in floating production units, dehydrate it and compress it, and transport it to Asia where it will be combusted and become atmospheric carbon dioxide. When we think of the impact of climate change on homes. It's perhaps the scenes of outright abandonment, inundation, and ruin that are perhaps the easiest to conjure. Lonely structures on dusty streets, too arid to support life. Buildings teetering on clifftops or immersed by floodwater. It's harder to picture the dwellings that waver unnervingly in status between being structures of sanctuary and danger. The intact iron roofs that proffer shelter from wind and rain, but also catch burning embers from bushfires in their eaves. The living room floors that accommodate the family couch, but also carry smells from fetid floodwater. The walls with blooms of mould behind the children's art. The bedrooms that cannot be reliably kept below wet bulb temperatures of 35 degrees, places of rest where sleepers may not rise in the morning. There is and will be a mundanity to the unravelling of life in these homes, an unpredictability and unsteadiness of their conversion from symbols of order, status and longing and security to sites of desperation, fear and necessity. Now, these quiet catastrophes are quite unlike those that the law readily recognises as environmental. They are not like oil spills in the Arctic, or bleached coral on the Great Barrier Reef, or the plight of the eastern curlew on the brink of extinction. Nor do they easily fit into the category of loss we associate as being threatened heritage. They are not like Notre Dame Cathedral aflame, or 40,000-year-old petroglyphs on the Burrup Peninsula eroding from nitrate emissions. Yet they shrink the spaces available for human sanctuary, and with them the preconditions for human physical, mental, and spiritual enlargement. They're generally non-spectacular, appearing as monumental only when viewed at scale. Now, the primary law governing what is known as Woodside's Scarborough Project is the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. I'll call it tonight the EPBC Act. It is a law which makes reference to the principle of intergenerational equity. Its objects concern the protection of matters of national environmental significance, the conservation of biodiversity, and the conservation of heritage, among others. As the Federal Court has recently confirmed, it is not concerned generally with the protection of the environment, nor with any response to global warming and climate change. Nor do its objects include the protection of the interests and safety of human beings and their environment on either an express or implied basis. Now, there are no World Heritage properties, national heritage places or wetlands of international importance 375 kilometres off the Pilbara coast and 1.5 kilometres down. It is cold, dark and heavy down there. The seabed that is currently safely encasing carbon tetrahydride is in the aphotic zone. It's a place too dark for photosynthesis. Deep water sponge gardens and octocorals grow at that depth, nourished by the plant and animal matter falling from above. The Phillips Australian Oil Company geologists who first drilled the site in the 1970s named it Jupiter, and a smaller adjacent gas field, Phoebe, for the planet's moon. These names have proved prescient in more ways than one. Not only is Jupiter a gas giant, it's also currently framed under Australian law as something like a place from outer space, conceptually apart from the lives and dwellings it has the power to unravel on the land. The proponents of the Scarborough Project are not heeding the International Energy Agency's plea that no new oil and gas fields can be approved for development from 2021. However, they have received initial regulatory approval under the requirements of the EPBC Act from NOPSEMA, the National Offshore Petroleum Safety and Environmental Management Authority, with delegated decision-making power over environmental matters under the Act. They have provided plans to deal with noise interference, vessel disturbance, light pollution, acute chemical discharge, and the potential degradation of the habitats of humpback whales, whale sharks, and turtle species that migrate and forage in the waters above Jupiter. They have satisfied the authority that the emissions they create will be managed to an acceptable level on the basis that they will displace more carbon-intensive power generation. In balancing the long-term and short-term economic, environmental, social, and equitable considerations mandated by the Act, the project of breaking apart the Jupiter seabed has been weighed and found acceptable. In my lecture tonight, I will argue that our current environmental laws offer an aperture for the recognition of lives threatened by climate change that is fundamentally misshapen. They are laws that take in and index the social and ecological world with a gaze that is too narrow and a temporal span that is too short to hear or give weight to the voices of the human lives made more precarious by climate instability. Nor do they attend to the rich webs of matter and meaning, time and species of which they are a part. They entrench a dangerous fantasy of heroic reason, the conceit that it is possible and desirable for one generation to weigh ontologically incommensurate concepts such as the economy on one hand and environmental, social, and equitable considerations on the other, and do so justly at one moment in time when the most grave consequences of such decisions are borne by future generations. In an Australia increasingly rich with ideas and political energy for decarbonising the economy, this narrow aperture of law holds us back, and it constrains the possibilities for how we might define and exercise climate responsibility on this wealthy and fossil-rich continent. In grappling with how we might widen the aperture of environmental law, I will argue that we are aided by a sense of historical imagination. In particular, I wish to recall that the Australian state has been capable of radically widening the categories of life it legally recognises and protects in the past. I will explore three such moments tonight. The first, in the early 20th century, where the minimum wage was protected as an entitlement that was understood to be necessary for the secure reproduction of working class life, albeit in a highly racialised and gendered context. The second is in the early 1990s, where the traditional laws and customs of Indigenous title holders were recognised by the Australian common law. In tracing the preconditions for these moments of expanded recognition, my approach is necessarily an anthropocentric one, guided by the symbols and markers of value that were prized by legal actors in the past. We will spend some time lingering, in particular, on the role of houses, fences, and gardens as icons of an ordered world. I will then contrast these with a third judicial encounter, the recent failed attempt of a group of Australian schoolchildren to seek legal recognition of a novel duty of care owed to them by the Minister for the Environment when making approvals for a coal mine extension under the EPBC Act. Now, each recognition moment I will describe was flawed. It was partial and it was impermanent, and I do not offer them as blueprints. However, I will argue that their logic has relevance for us today in their preparedness to recognise human communities under threat from development and to hear and to see their social, political and physical dimensions, rather than merely manage extraction. Now, in making this argument, I invite you to put to one side ideas of Australia as a quarry nation, inevitably condemned by its geography to extraction. It is, of course, easy enough to find evidence to support this thesis in a polity where elected MPs have openly declared, "We're in the coal business." But tonight I will instead follow Stuart McIntyre's analytic perspective on the Australian democratic state as an entity with a twin face, an instrument of control and coercion that simultaneously responded to demands for social justice, expanding in responsibility with them. I speak tonight in recognition, too, of the astonishing span and prescience of the historian in whose name I give this lecture, W.K. Hancock. Throughout his long and diverse career, Hancock was consistently attuned to both the variability in senses of environmental responsibility exhibited by Australian colonists and the very high stakes of indifference to ecological limits. In 1930, he would write of Australia as a site of invasion where pastoralists would preach with the fervour of tyrannical patriotism their strange gospel of Australia Unlimited, as they drained the artesian waters, those spreading waterbeds protected from the sun, more precious than rivers. His portrait of Monaro, published in 1972, was introduced in terms that, if we leave the gendered language aside, are not out of place in 2022. He introduced it with reference to the anxious concern felt by all thoughtful people about the misuse of the land, and the fact that those thin envelopes of air, water, and soil, without which neither men, nor animals, nor plants, nor insects could survive, have become painfully vulnerable to the massive powers possessed by modern man. Hancock was a master of the scholarly evocation of encounter, and my narrative tonight is indebted to him. So, my first encounter I'll describe occurred at a cottage in Broken Hill in 1909. When Justice Henry Bourne Higgins visited workers' dwellings at Broken Hill to gather evidence for a case concerning the limits of the arbitration court's power in settling industrial disputes, he spent some time thinking about fences and gardens, or rather, their absence. Workers in the BHP mine, he explained in his judgment, have to face unbroken desert on all sides, and dun, dreary, desolate, and grassless and treeless plains with all-pervading dust and grime, with water scarce and dear and impure. The workers' houses were generally of galvanised iron, lined with hessian and wood, without garden or fence, without bath, hot as ovens in summer, cold in the extreme in winter. Within these homes, and sometimes he slipped into the terminology of iron sheds, there was a troubling preponderance of tinned milk rather than fresh, a cause, he asserted in his judgment, of an abnormally great infant mortality. Of dire concern, too, was the evidence that women in these households occasionally had to take in laundry work or do nursing to make ends meet, a pathetic fact, according to Higgins, that pointed to the fragility of the gendered division of labour and with it the secure reproduction of the white race. Just one witness's name for the workers was recorded in the BHP judgment, a Mrs. Mann, wife of a labourer, whose unusually high household expenditure list was, together with the uninsulated walls, the tinned milk, the nursing work, and the absent fences and gardens, woven into a portrait of domestic, industrial and societal precarity. He wrote, "Unless great multitudes of people are to be irretrievably injured in themselves and in their families, unless society is to be perpetually in industrial unrest, a living wage was required to be paid to the male breadwinner as a thing sacrosanct beyond the reach of bargaining, payable regardless of whether the employer's profits were large or small." The workers' dwelling in Broken Hill thus stood as a kind of synecdoche for a young nation, its absent fences and gardens a troubling reminder that its future status as civilised, productive and prosperous was not assured. Fair and reasonable wage, living wage, of course, was not Higgins' idea. It had been a long-standing demand of monster demonstrations of workers since the 1890s. It was an element of the 1891 papal encyclical, Rerum Novarum, and it had been enshrined in New Zealand and colonial legislatures, as well as, crucially, the Commonwealth Tariff Act, which required employers to pay a reasonable and fair wage as a condition for receiving subsidies. Essential to Higgins' judgment was not only the entrenched legal and social status of the concept, it was also a philosophical orientation to the law and state power as crucial instruments for human and national progress. The court was, he would famously write, an attempt to substitute the use of reason for the use of economic force in disputes as to the conditions of labour. Just as the private wars of barons were in past centuries stopped under the supremacy of law, and as the duel has been stopped, this was the deliberate subordination of private power to public interest, a complement and enhancement to the legislative measures already in place in the Arbitration and Conciliation Act that wired in the recognition of collective worker voice into the machinery of wage determination and dispute resolution in the Federation. Now, Higgins was not an environmentalist by any modern definition. He was deeply committed to competitive industry and the productive use of land through agriculture and mining. He saw the prospect of closure of mines and mills at Broken Hill as a catastrophe. However, he wrote, "If it is a calamity that this historic mine should close down, it would be still a greater calamity that men should be underfed or degraded." BHP operations were, consequently, interrupted for 2 years because the company wished to avoid having to pay the prescribed rate. Higgins later defended the living wage against pressure to extract coal from political authorities as high as the Prime Minister, and popular commitment to the idea that the owners of coal mines should be subject to the same industrial rules that applied to unions contributed to the toppling of the Bruce government in 1929. In 1930, this sense of the subordination of fossil interests to social principle was so widely held that W.K. Hancock described Australia as a place where manufacturers must make economic facts conform to the idea of justice. If an industry is unable to achieve this, it must die. The living wage principle was understood to be part of the social fabric well into the mid-century, exercising in the assessment of one young ANU doctoral student, R.J. Hawke, in 1956, an almost divine authority in the eyes of the court. Of course, it could not last. And the terms of the unravelling of the living wage principle are as instructive for us as the terms of its recognition. While political and legal opposition to the principle from employer groups was fierce and sustained, they sought a return to the clear, open economic ring in employment matters. The crucial dynamic in its weakening arguably didn't come from a direct attack, but rather from supplementation of the principle with another, employer capacity to pay. In the 1930s, industrial courts were required to consider sound economic doctrine and balance the favourable and adverse effects of higher wages in calculating the minimum wage. Where the working class household had once stood as both symbol and source of societal well-being, it was now a stakeholder whose interests were to be calculated relative to those of others, including the economy itself. Something of the ontological dislocation of this shift is captured by an account of wage determination hearings following the change cited by the historian Laura Bennett. The trade union representatives were way out of their depths. They were not economists. Most of them had come out of the workshops. They had been accustomed to arguing about such items as the cost of workers' clothing, the time needed to complete a certain job, the amount of experience required before a man became skilled in a certain industrial operation. But they could not discuss international trade balances, the incidence of tariffs, fluctuations in the stock exchange quotations, or talk in terms of index figures. Now, this demotion of worker need from sacrosanct concern to mere factor persists in employment legislation today. The Fair Work Act, despite its title, does not take as its object the rebalancing of power inherent in employment relationships. It rather aims to provide a balanced framework for cooperative and productive workplace relations, with reference to a range of ideas that are ostensibly at odds with worker recognition, flexibility, productivity, economic growth. It's a crucial shift, and as we will see, one not unique to labour law. Now to my second encounter. This occurred at garden plots in the island of Mur in 1989. When Justice Moynihan took evidence on the island of Mur in the Torres Strait in 1989, gardens and fences were also on his mind. Unlike Justice Higgins, whose declaration of the fair and reasonable standard had been brought by an employer, Justice Moynihan found himself examining dwellings on Mur by virtue of an application set in motion to the High Court by the inhabitants of those structures, Eddie Koike Mabo, James Rice, James Passy and others, who sought common law recognition of native title. Justice Moynihan was a Queensland Supreme Court judge, tasked by the High Court with hearing the evidence and determining the facts. On the 5 kilometre long and 3 kilometre wide island, he observed tidy house plots and garden areas, fish traps and boundary markers comprised of rocks and wooden fences. Unlike the evidence taken by Higgins at Broken Hill, The connections that link together the fences, the gardens, the dwellings, and the intergenerational transmission of life were not the product of judicial inference. They were, rather, the subject of direct evidence provided by the people that lived there. Over 67 hearing days on the island and the mainland, 44 witnesses gave detailed evidence as to the interrelationship of culture, belief, practice, land, and work that sustained community life. Father Dave Passy, for instance, explained how the Bonmei-Malo cult and the laws of Malo and Christianity brought by missionaries on Darnley Island in 1871 fitted together in an integrated philosophy of being and creation. The testimony of the claimants was accompanied by parallel evidence given by an expert, anthropologist Jeremy Beckett. Despite some equivocations, Moynihan's finding of fact were adequate for the High Court to conclude, in Justice Dean's words, that there was the clear inference that there was a native system under which all land was recognised as being in the possession of a particular individual or family group. Justice Brennan recognised the entwinement of religious, cultural, and economic subsistence which the land provides, observing that gardening practices in particular were a focus point for rituals and other aspects of the social fabric that was passed between the generations. As in Harvester, a standard that was simultaneously socially accepted and legally enshrined in Commonwealth law was crucial. In this case, the idea of racial equality entrenched in the Racial Discrimination Act 1975 and just terms protection entrenched in the Constitution. As with the recognition and protection of the fair and reasonable standard, the recognition of native title had long antecedents. Global struggles for decolonisation and anti-segregation had predated the proposed reforms by the Bjelke-Petersen government to repeal the Torres Strait Islanders Act, which were the immediate impetus for the claim. Crucial too were memories of the 1966 Wave Hill strike, the 1967 referendum and Bark petition, and a variety of international precedents for the recognition of native title, and, crucially, the 1971 land rights case. In that decision, Justice Blackburn had recognised a system of customary laws and held that the proposed Nabalco bauxite mine would destroy plants, animal life, and the culture of the people. The case had only failed because he had also held that the system did not contain rights in land that could be recognised by the Australian common law. A meta-narrative about the role of law as an instrument of progress was apparent in Mabo, as it had been in Harvester. The common law was not, the High Court held, frozen in an age of racial discrimination. The peace and order of Australian society is built on the legal system. It can be modified to bring it into conformity with contemporary notions of justice and human rights, but it cannot be destroyed. A notion of civility was apparent too. Deprivation of religious, cultural, and economic substance which the land provides made the Indigenous inhabitants intruders in their own homes and mendicants for a place to live. Judged by a civilised standard, such a law is unjust. Now, as in Harvester, the decision met with heavy direct opposition from employer associations and companies who mobilised aggressive political campaigns and legal appeals in an attempt to overturn the decision and staunch its potency. But as with the living wage, we must also attend not only to such direct attacks, but also to what happened when the common law recognition was translated into legislation. Section 223 of the Native Title Act presented a space of recognition, or in Shauna Dorset and Sean McVeigh's resonant phrase, a meeting place of laws, for the communal, group and individual rights and interests of Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Island in relation to land and waters. However, at the same time, the Act entrenched an apparatus for managing native title and for rendering certain its capacity to interrupt capital and processes of extraction. Potential clashes between native title rights and future developments were and are managed through what was termed with dystopian poignancy a Future Act regime that grants time-constrained and highly conditional rights to registered claimants to negotiate rather than veto developers' plans. The weighing and balancing of ontologically incommensurate values is central to the process. The National Native Title Tribunal must perform a calculation. to consider the effects of the Act on registered native title rights on the one hand, and the economic or other significance of the Act to Australia, the state or territory concerned, including the public interest, on the other. Now, few native title holders or applicants have attempted to use these provisions to stop developments on their traditional land and waters unconditionally. In the many thousands of future acts approved through the NTA between 1992 and 2009, legal scholars have found only three applications that asked developments to be refused per se, and only one successfully, a mining lease for potash over places that included sites of exceptional cultural significance to the Mardu people, in a case run by highly experienced counsel with extensive and detailed evidence. In that instance, the tribunal held that the benefits offered to the claimants, in this case the upgrading of a road and the possibility of employment and business opportunities, were not sufficient to outweigh the substantial interference with traditional sites. So what began in Mabo as an effort to recognise and protect traditional laws and customs from unjust extinguishment in all their routine and everyday manifestations ended in a managerial regime, one that, like the task of industrial courts in the 1930s, was predicated on the capacity of executive decision makers to balance and weigh highly incommensurate concepts in a manner that, in practice, resulted in a subordinating extraction only in the most exceptional of circumstances. Okay, to my third encounter now, an encounter with statistical life in Melbourne, 2021. There were no physical gardens, fences, or dwellings inspected in the evidence provided to Justice Bromberg in the class action brought by Anjali Sharma and seven other schoolchildren for the recognition of a novel duty of care owed to them and to children who ordinarily reside in Australia by the Minister of the Environment when making approvals under the EPBC. They were there implicitly in the voluminous evidence given by experts of the destabilising impacts of rising atmospheric carbon on presently inhabitable spaces, but they did not appear by name. The children themselves were not witnesses in the case, a logical necessity given their indeterminate number and the fact that only a tiny fraction of their class is presently alive. Instead, experts in climate and earth system science, energy and emissions modelling, epidemiology, population health and actuarial accounting painted portrait after dire portrait of the destruction of life and its material preconditions in numbers, none of which was contested evidence by the minister. 1 million Australian children, the court was told, were expected to suffer at least one heat stress episode serious enough to require acute care in a hospital between 2060 and 2080. Excess mortality from heat was expected to be 12% in persons aged over 65 years. Justice Bromberg drew on these and other myriad data points into a declension narrative of the nation. I quote, "As Australian adults know their country, Australia will be lost and the world we know it gone as well. The physical environment will be harsher, far more extreme and devastatingly brutal when angry. As for the human experience, quality of life, opportunities to partake in nature's treasures, the capacity to grow and prosper, all will be greatly diminished. Lives will be cut short. Trauma will be far more common and good health harder to hold and maintain. None of this will be the fault of nature itself. It will be largely inflicted by the inaction of this generation of adults in what may fairly be described as the greatest intergenerational injustice ever inflicted by one generation of humans upon the next." The claimant's reliance on the tort of negligence meant that no equivalent of the public fair and reasonable standard of harvester or the prohibition of racial discrimination in Mabo was invoked in the Sharma case. Justice Bromberg's task, rather, was to consider whether a duty of care in tort was to be imported into the structure of the lawful exercise of the minister's powers under the Act. This required him to evaluate whether the posited duty was coherent, compatible, and harmonious with the structure and purpose of the statute. He found that a duty of care did arise but a finding that was overturned by the full bench in March this year on the basis that, among other things, the EPBC Act is not concerned generally with the protection of the environment, nor is there any part of the Act that is expressly concerned with greenhouse gases, global warming, or climate change. The WA government has granted permission for the extraction of carbon tetrahydride from the Jupiter gas field in a state agreement that runs until 2059. That is 9 years after the entire Earth needs to be at net zero emissions. It's 38 years after the last date by which the IEA has said that new fossil fuel infrastructure building must cease. Decommissioning of the 30,000 tonne platform and the 430 kilometres of pipeline is not expected to commence until 2055. Now, in that time, there will almost certainly be improvements in the capacity of regulators to reject applications for new fossil fuel projects. Decisions such as the New South Wales Land and Environment Court's finding in Gloucester Resources and the Minister for Planning have confirmed that decision makers in New South Wales must consider downstream Scope 3 emissions and reject market substitution arguments. This shows that change is underway. Improvements will also be made, almost certainly, to the EPBC Act to improve its effectiveness in protecting nationally important environmental matters, including the implementation of many, if not all, of the 12 key reforms recommended in the 2020 Samuel Independent Statutory Review. Politics at local and federal levels will continue to shift. As well as the election of new MPs and governments, new configurations of ideology and alliance, we will see a continued escalation of struggles against fossil extraction on the ground as local communities, traditional owners, unions, environmentalists, farmers, youth organisations and others assert their right to strive towards alternative versions of prosperity that are decarbonised, decommodified and more democratic. We will be likely to see new and familiar political frameworks and ideas for re-embedding the economy, such as foundational economies, just transitions, cooperatives, and environmental justice movements. These will continue to grow and expand in their sophistication and reach. Through all these changes, we should continue to hold in view the narrow shape of the aperture of environmental law, for as long as it carries the shape that I have sketched here tonight. And we should think about how it structures and constrains these developments. We should remember how strange it is that our primary federal legislation protecting the environment purports to enshrine principles of ecologically sustainable development and intergenerational equity, but does not take into account the safety of human beings and the structures and systems that offer them daily sanctuary. That vests power in a tiny number of people at one moment in time to permit major climate destabilising events to occur on the basis of weighing and calculating considerations that are narrow and ontologically incommensurate. That accords virtually no provision for giving weight to the voices of the masses of people whose lives will be truncated by climate change in the present or the future. Now, in situating such laws within a longer history of reconfigured responsibility in Australia, I have tried to convey three things. Firstly, that Australian law, for all the resource abundance of this continent, has the capacity for self-interruption. It can and has held back mines on the basis of principles oriented to protect life in the past. Secondly, in the encounters I've described tonight, neither information about the interdependence of life systems, nor threats of imminent destruction, nor good ideas for taming capital, nor social pressure for change were enough on their own to restrain fossil extraction. The recognition moments that took place in Harvester, Mabo and Sharma were rather expressions of historical conjunctures. That is, to use Stuart Hall's definition, periods during which different social, political, economic and ideological contradictions that are at work in society come together to give it a specific and distinctive shape. Any given conjuncture is never entirely stable, only more or less stable, whether due to social or political antagonisms, structural contradictions and/or present or impending crises. Now, the conjunctures that made Harvester and Mabo possible included legally enshrined public principles that were widely shared by a significant proportion of society, the norm of the fair and reasonable wage that was encoded in the Tariff Act in Harvester, and the unlawfulness of racial discrimination and the requirement for just terms compensation in the Racial Discrimination Act and the Constitution in Mabo. These laws, in turn, existed because of decades of demands and struggles by social movements. They also included a narrative of the Australian law itself as an instrument of social progress, civility, and enlightenment. It is hard to detect obvious counterparts, either in terms of public principle or a narrative of the role of law in the Sharma case. Now, to be very clear, I am not making an argument here for heroic judicial activism in the past or the future. All of the judges I've mentioned here were performing a prescribed role. They were hearing the carefully crafted arguments of litigants before them and adjudicating outcomes based on an interpretation of laws passed by parliaments and the common law. What they determined and the possibilities they perceived for the common law was a reflection of the conjunctures of their times. The widening of legal frameworks in response to climate change must be the work of parliaments, not judges, responding to the demands of us as citizens. Thirdly, I've tried to emphasise the importance of disentangling legal efforts at recognition of intergenerational obligation and the management of competing interests on the other. I've tried to show that these processes may coexist, and where they do, may see acts of recognition functionally undermined and rendered politically sterile in practice. Harvester and Mabo both recognised webs of relationality that were dynamic and extended through time without limit. In Mabo, this span of recognition accorded weight to laws and customs relating to human relationships with non-human entities, to fish and banana plants. The potency of that recognition was palpably diminished once its subjects were reduced to stakeholder status, with interest to be balanced against ontologically expansive notions such as the national interest and productivity. This shift from protective laws premised on recognition to processes concerned with interest management happened over decades in the case of Harvester. It happened quickly between 1992 and 1993 in the case of Mabo. In the EPBC Act, by contrast, this may be understood as an act born managerial, containing no element of recognition from the beginning. What alternatives exist? There are no ready-to-hand prescriptions for widening the shape of the aperture of environmental law to fit the climate-changed age. Now, it is worth observing here that Australia has no right to a livable or healthy environment enshrined in the Constitution. Although we need only glance towards the acrimonious contest over constitutionally embedded rights to life in North America to be cautious about the idea that this might provide a simple fix. It is certain that an ensemble of legislative and potentially constitutional changes will be necessary that include and go beyond what we presently think of as environmental law to enable us to exercise climate responsibility commensurate with the power our fossil endowment has enabled. What might this widened horizon aim to achieve, if not the mere management of extraction, and what should guide its shape? Answering this question requires, foundationally, a realism about the shape of the climate catastrophe and its profound non-similarity with the forms of environmental destruction that loomed large in the 1970s, when the notion of intergenerational justice, premised on balancing different pillars of sustainable development in a non-prescriptive way, when that first came to global prominence with the Stockholm Convention. It requires a preparedness to lay aside our mental habits of privileging the exceptional, whether defined scientifically, historically, or aesthetically, and the spatially proximate as delimiting categories for what the law should protect and recognise from environmental harm. For climate change does not cleave to these boundaries, and nor do the other planetary boundaries being surpassed. And it will be non-spectacular events that will be determinative in shortening and narrowing lives in this century as much as iconic ones. Instead, we must consider how our law might instead give expression to the IPCC's call for a deliberate weakening of high-carbon systems and the encouragement of low-carbon systems in a deliberate and rapid way. This requires laws that can hear as well as see the social and political dimensions of climate destruction, and allow that destruction to be registered in direct human speech, not merely in statistics and technical measures recounted by experts. It is only through such means that the law can bridge what the legal theorist Alain Supion has put it, the world of sense and the world of the senses. It requires us to reconsider how we classify loss and threat in terms of their quality as private problems or public issues. Private law instruments of tort, contract and property are and surely will prove inadequate tools for dealing with what will be vast, collective and highly unequal experiences of dehoming and exile in an age of climate breakdown. The legal and policy instruments we choose for ordering our society in such conditions and the extent to which we permit them to have a public and universal character will have a significant bearing on our capacity to meet these challenges with cooperation, care and creativity. Laws are required which are accessible, clear and capable of decisively prohibiting new fossil capital projects from being commenced and winding down existing ones in a timely, principled and just manner. They should be attuned to the true temporal dimensions of new fossil extractive projects and the path dependencies they set in train. Histories of technology, such as David Edgerton's outstanding book, The Shock of the Old, are invariably histories of coexistence that reveal the old, whether it's the prevalence of coal as an energy source or the number of horses used for military purposes in the Second World War, the old tends to stick around a lot longer than we think. Projects such as Scarborough are not bridge fuel initiatives that politely span neat historical eras between coal and renewables, willingly dismantling themselves at some anointed moment of green energy arrival. They are long-term, heavy infrastructures of extraction. They are designed, constructed, and financed to extract carbon tetrahydride from the seabed for profit and to do it until there is none left. They are indifferent to the presence or absence of solar panels on the shore. A widened horizon of law, appropriately framed, would foster and strengthen grassroots movements of all kinds seeking to subordinate the economy to society and potentially ease some of the impossible burdens of expectation currently placed on the shoulders of traditional owner groups and workers in different industries who, as well as trying to build power and struggle in their own communities, are currently expected to save the planet as well. While, of course, many members of these groups willingly embrace these aims, it's unfair and unrealistic to expect groups to do so with perfect political unanimity or as agents of people they've never met. To quote the children's statement of claim in the Sharma case, today's adults have gained both previously unimaginable power to harm tomorrow's adults and the ability to control that harm. The applicants seek the aid of the court to impose a correlative responsibility to protect them from what they say is a serious threat of irreversible future harm. Now, this demand is surely sound. However, courts cannot assist them for as long as our legal frameworks are not equipped to recognise and protect the conditions of life. It's up to us to insist on laws made by parliaments that ensure that the Jupiter gas field is regulated as if it were a place that is on Earth. The logic underpinning Harvester and Mabo, the conscious subordination of the interests of industry to the protection of life through law, has much to offer us in widening our imagination for our current predicament. Now, the lives the law recognises should not have to meet anything like the prescriptive, racist and patriarchal standards imposed by Justice Higgins, nor could they possibly conform to the traditional laws and customs of the Meriam people. Homes need not have fences and private gardens to merit protection. But it is within our reach to craft laws that recognise the imperative that humans have spaces of sanctuary, where minds and bodies may be renewed and selves developed and nurtured within a common social world. Australian law has shown the capability of recognising such claims as entitlements in the past, and it may do so again.